Is that the beautiful Vicky Woodyard? Hello, Vicky. Vicky.
Are you?
Yes.
All right.
One little detail. I didn't put the little pot up on the board there, so you were mute there for a second.
We're kind of amateurs.
Vicky.
We're just stumbling through our way.
Now you're just trying to make me feel better.
We all feel like Forrest Gumps.
Yeah.
We do. Yeah.
You don't have to worry. We'll make fools out of ourselves.
Oh, great.
Our very special guest today, author Vicky Woodyard, has lived a life both rocky and spiritually centered, with her husband Bob dying of multiple myeloma, a fatal cancer of the bone marrow, in 2004, and her only daughter also lost to cancer at the age of 7. Her book, Life with a Hole in It, That's How the Light Gets In, tells her story in an honest and humble way, opening the reader's own heart to what is worth living for. Vicky's humorous writing style holds nothing back as she invites you to consider what you are living for. Awakening, she would say, is still a dream until you sink into the heart. But when you're caught in the dream, it just means you've temporarily forgotten. Vicky's writing serves as a bookmark to help you find your place again. So happy to have you on. As our very, very first sage on our new upticked conversations with avant-garde sages, I think you're the perfect first.
The first one.
Yeah. That sounds very French to me.
Well, I think you're the perfect first avant-garde sage to be on our show because you're very, very real. There's, and you're not afraid to show how real you are, to share the difficulties that you've had in your life. And I think that does people a great service because one of the things that obstructs people is this idea that there's some kind of saintly model of behavior. And the wizard is always talking about that. So he really appreciated your writing and how real you are.
Well, the book covers a 5-year period when my husband was suffering from his fatal cancer. And even though I was on the spiritual path, I was not prepared to lose him because we had lost our daughter. And so I knew when they said his cancer was fatal, I had no false hope. And I seemed to lose touch with all the hard inner work that I had done. It was just out the window. I was grieving. I was desperate. I had always leaned on my husband. He was supposedly the rock. And I was supposedly the frailer of the two. And all of a sudden, I remember telling my son, I said, it's like somebody blew the whistle. Everybody was marching in one direction, and the whistle blew, and we all had to turn around and march the other way, which was right back into hell that we all knew. You know, we knew what it was like to bury a child. But now we were going to bury the strongest one in the family. And when Bob was diagnosed in the hospital, they started him immediately on very high doses of chemo, and there were a lot of steroids in there. And he had a psychotic reaction to the steroids. This is an unfortunate side effect. And he just lost it. Not violently, but it's a very moving story. They called me from the hospital, and they said, Ms. Woodyard, we think you need to get up here right away because your husband has pulled out all the lines, the central lines where he was getting his IV fluids and where his port was, and they found him completely dressed roaming the hospital halls. So I got a neighbor to take me to the hospital. It took me about an hour before I got there, and so when I walked into his room, he was sitting there on the bed, fully dressed, and his pants were soiled. They had given him an enema, and he was sitting in his own stuff, and this beatific smile was on his face. He called me Angel, and he said, Angel, I am so glad to see you. He said, I was getting ready to walk home to see you. He had packed everything that he could in the hospital room, put his flowers like on the cart. He was an engineer. He's very prepared. Put the loose change I'd left him for Coke, put it in his pocket. And he was just beaming. He was joyful that I was there. And they had given him a shot, you know, to calm him down. Well, he was completely cuckoo for several weeks. And one day I had come home, and I took the dog out for a walk and stepped in dog duty. Went back up to the hospital, was just exhausted. And sitting there in his room, and I looked down, and I thought, oh, my goodness, I have dog duty on my shoe. And in this sterile environment, you know, there it is. So I got up, and I went into the family lounge. And I went to the restroom there, and I took one shoe off and stuck it in the sink, and I was gagging and crying and gagging and crying. It was just a mess. So I went back out into the family lounge. Well, now there were like five or six people there. There I was with my shoe in my hand and tears running down my face. So I just told them what happened. Well, this man, the patient in there, he said, the same thing happened to me. He said, I just went crazy on steroids. And he said, I thought that there was a giant hot dog at the foot of my bed. And he said, I kept asking everybody to put relish on it. Well, we started to laugh, and we just sat there and laughed and cried together. Mm-hmm. And so I got home that night, and I went into the computer, and my bowels released. I didn't do it. It just happened. I went into my bedroom, and our dog had thrown up right underneath my pillow. And that was a revelation. I thought, you know, I am the unclean one. There's no division. I can't. His pants were soiled. Mine got soiled. There was vomit on the bed. And I just knew that everything was like it was. And to me, that was just, I don't know, it was amazing. Bob continued in a blessed state, and he said he had seen the light. He said, I saw the light in the mountaintop, and he said, I want you to take me there. And I write in the book, I said, well, I told him I could because, you know, everything else was that crazy. So, I mean, what else could I do? You know, I said, sure.
Well, let me ask you.
Oh, I wanted to say one more thing, Trip. He had asked, but right before his break, he asked my son and I to go get a tape recorder. And he spent an hour recording about how we had met and fallen in love. And he said, I want you to find your passion before I die. So my conversation with you and all my writing is an outgrowth of that. So I can go to the dark places because of that love that's undergirding it, that feeds it.
Well, you just mentioned there's no division, and you've had, though, these traumatic experiences where these people that you loved so deeply died. One of the tenets of non-dual wisdom is there truly no others. So I'm wondering, have you come to a place where your perception of your loved ones is none other than yourself, or is this just sort of spiritual platitude and has no place in the real world of tragedy and loss?
I would say it's the latter. I would say, I don't like the word enlightenment. I like the word wholeness. My wholeness cannot be broken, but when it's seemingly broken, it really hurts. And I speak to that when I write. Because if you don't, there is a certain coldness, a certain intellectual bystander thing happening, that once you've buried a child, you can't, there's no resonance. You know, if what I write has no resonance, I might as well stop.
Speaking of your daughter, let's on her tombstone, there's an inscription that reads, "Christ in you, the hope of glory." What's the meaning of that?
Those words came unbidden to me right before she died, and I just said that's what I want on her gravestone. The Colossians says something about the mystery of you within, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. That is the I am awareness. That is the Christ consciousness that we are. And the suffering that we seemingly undergo is apparently a part of being born onto this earth plane. And I have used it to walk as far down the path as I can this lifetime. There's a Sufi sentence that I love in a book. I think the name of it's Writing on the Water, and his teacher tells him, at some point, it's not enough to live close to the school. You have to become the school. We have to become the Christ consciousness that we already are, paradoxically. You just have to stop your intellectual babbling and drop down into your wholeness.
Is that compatible with, or is it happening at the same time that one is grieving over one's loss?
I don't think so. I think that one thing Vernon Howard taught me was conscious suffering. Awareness is the solvent of suffering. We all have emotional ups and downs. We're human. And at the point at which you can catch yourself in a state of emotional suffering, you remember yourself, and the spell is broken, and you reclaim your wholeness. But it's a journey. It's not a destination. It's a spiral journey. At least it has been for me.
Wizard, you jump in anytime you want, right?
Hey, John.
I like the solvent part.
Yeah.
That awareness is that solvent.
Uh-huh.
And it's pure medicine.
Yes.
In that regard. I love the way you phrase that.
I think you and the Wizard are birds of a feather.
Yeah, we're a little cuckoo.
Yeah, cuckoo birds.
Well, I was just reading a wonderful thing that Robert Rabin has on Jerry Katz's blog, in which he says that if you can't use humor in your talking, for him, he says he has to use humor. Otherwise, it's just boring. And I'm just wired the same way.
Okay, well, you have a humorous writing style, and, you know, most writers polish and polish away to make sure that anything they put out in the public domain really reflects what they're feeling, and every single word is carefully crafted. But when you write, typos are accepted as well as perfect copy. So why are you so comfortable letting your writing hair down in public?
I just love it. I just love what I do. I love writing, and I love writing raw. And I say that's God's little joke on me, because my personality is very quiet. I'm an introvert, very reserved. And I don't go around talking to people that I know like I'm talking to you guys. This is spiritual talk. You know, this is between spiritual friends. But it's God's little joke on me that when I write, I just tell it like it is. Now I see it as a gift, and I use it in that sense. That when I sit down to write my Facebook notes, actually, if people knew how long it took me, they would gasp. It doesn't take me any time at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're there. You know, they're just there waiting. They're lining up, waiting to be written, if you will.
You still have a spiritual relationship with your loved ones. And I in reading through your writing, I want to ask you something that came up for me.
Okay.
You write from what used to be a sense of loss, and now it's a sense of peace. And you say, what I have lost cannot be restored. It can be hallowed and connected to in a very real way. Those I love who have passed beyond the veil are reading everything that my heart writes. And I'm wondering, are you saying that your loved ones continue to exist in spiritual form, or are you sort of speaking to the universal listening ear that they've now merged with, or what?
I actually believe that. I had a very vivid dream, and it's in the last pages of my book, where Bob in the dream came back from the dead, and he was like wearing grave clothes, and he was not speaking to me. He was speaking to a small crowd of people, and he seemed to be telling them things that they knew, or he knew about them, and they needed to hear. And I was like a bystander, And then, after he finished doing that, he walked over to me, and he was carrying a book. And he began to open the pages and indicating for me to look at what he had written. And then he said, "Your prayers are written on the wall of my heart every day." And I woke up with a start, and I knew that was the truth. I just knew it. Now, I do not dream of him very often. It's very rare. And I would say it's only a couple of times that I've actually felt his presence. But that message was a deep teaching for me. Now, there's another quote from a book I love that says, "Every prayer that seemingly goes out into the universe is really answered within your own heart." So perhaps this is my own heart speaking. It doesn't matter. I felt heard.
I felt when very close friends of mine have dropped the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I feel a communion far more closer than when alive, because the form is out of the way.
Exactly.
And the formless aspects merge. And the being able to be in touch with that is being in touch with the self. And as time goes by, the apparition slowly fades away, leaving the immaculate residue of the self.
Yes. And I have joked and said that I love Bob much more now because the personality issues are gone.
Yeah.
And this deepens the connection with the self.
And that,
ever present.
At that time, right after a death, when there's the loss of the form, but still the apparition of the form, is like the finest wine imaginable, and to savor it. I tell friends when they're losing a loved one, savor it. Savor it. It's precious.
Well, you know, Bob died right at Christmas. And he went into hospice on December 16th in 2004, and luckily he was just there 4 days. And he was buried in Memphis, Tennessee, where we were from. So the service was on December the 23rd, and an ice storm was on the way, and we were not really aware of it because we were in shock, and we had to get him buried. Christmas was bearing down, and the storm was bearing down, too. And so during his service, sleet started pinging the roof of the funeral home. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, my goodness, we're not even going to get to have the graveside service. And by the time we were seated for the graveside service, I told the minister, I said, "You're going to have to hurry through because the sleet is already, it was covering the cemetery, and it was a beautiful sight because there were red poinsettias on all the graves, and the sleet was coating everything in ice." So after the service, we went back to the funeral home, and my sister and one of Bob's cousins had had their purses stolen in the funeral parking lot. They had both left their purses in the car, and their cars were ripped off. So she had to go up to her room and cancel her credit cards. By the time she got finished with that, we were iced in at the Marriott and could not even go to his brother's house to have a meal with the family. We were held there at the Marriott for 3 days. And you talk about a holy time. There were scarcely any people staying. The only people in the Marriott were people that couldn't get out of town because of the ice. So Christmas Eve morning, I told the server in the dining room, I said, "I don't know what we're going to do to eat tonight, Christmas Eve, because everything's closed anyway for Christmas Eve, and now the ice is." And she said, "Well, I'll tell you, I'm supposed to be here to serve breakfast in the morning, and they've asked me to sleep over at the courtyard." And she said they have given all the employees honey-baked ham. So she said, I'm going to bring my ham back here tonight with all the fixings, and we're going to have our Christmas Eve dinner.
All right.
So it was my son, my sister, my cousin, and I. I was too tired to get out. I went to the room and rested. But the three of them walked to a drugstore and a convenience store and bought stocking stuffers. For stockings, they used liquor bags because they were in the shape of a foot. They were long and skinny. And they brought Mary, the one that was cooking the dinner, they brought her a Santa hat with her name and glitter on it. So that night, Christmas Eve now, right after we buried Bob on the 23rd, there were five of us in the lobby of the courtyard. There was an artificial tree and a gas fireplace. It was completely still, and it was O Holy Night. It was blessed. And the five of us sat there and were actually joyful. We all knew something magical had happened. The next day was Christmas Day. We got the last seats on the airplane back to Atlanta, and I had crackers from a machine for Christmas dinner. Then we got home and found out the tsunami had hit that year, you know, the one in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the ending to his life in the beginning of my new life. Everything was swept clean.
Mm-hmm. I was flying into India at the time the tsunami hit.
You were?
Yeah, my wife and I had been in Thailand, and just as we took off, the earthquake hit, and no one on the plane knew it, and we literally flew across with the tsunami, and it hit Madras, or Chennai as they call it, just before we passed over. And when we got to the airport, the people at the airport had not yet heard about it. But we looked down and saw that. And then we went off to visit the ashram of Ramana Maharshi there. And the peace was just unbreakable.
Yeah.
And we didn't find out about the tsunami until the next day when we went across the street to get some coffee, and all the Westerners there were talking about it. There was not a mention of it at the ashram.
Well, it was very strange to me how there was nothing. I had no reactions left to anything at that point, so I was in that zone that you're talking about. That I had a precognitive dream. My sister is the disciple of Amma, whose ashram is.
Yes.
Kerala. And I had this funny dream of two elephants going up a gangplank. Later I saw that there were two elephants in Amma's ashram, and there was an actual photograph of her helping push the elephants to safety going up this gangplank. So in a sense, everything has already happened. I believe that.
Yes.
We're just looking through a peephole and seeing one event at a time, but on a higher level, it's happened already.
So, dear listeners, you're listening to Conversations with Avant-Garde Sages, and our special guest today is author Vicki Woodyard. And if you would like to email a question into Vicki, you can do that by emailing me at Zortacular, Zortacular, at gmail.com. We'd be happy to get your question on the air. Vicki, you advise letting go of the questions, which is, I think, been something that only recently I've been able to get comfortable with. My mind was just afire with questions for several years, but now that they've all been answered about 100 times,
yeah.
I'm really able to let go of them. This is kind of a sadhana, this radio program, because I ask a lot of questions that I know the answers to already. But you as a writer, and then, you know, I'm also a writer, and I actually might crank that up. You as a writer, you spend most of your time exploring questions, and yet you advise letting go of them. So what's going on there?
Oh, when I write, as I say, these essays are really already written. I'm just there. My fingers are just there at the keyboard. And, I mean, I don't fear looking at them, but I'm not asking them intellectually. I have no interest in the intellect's parsing of I am. You know, I talk about that and squawk about that a lot and make jokes about it, how some people are in such a loop of parsing I am, they're stuck in their head. And I said, I'm tired of living in my head. There's not enough room in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to just eventually drop down into being and just say, here I am. Here I am.
Here I am, and everything's okay.
Yes.
Well, now, I want to talk a little bit about your teacher, Vernon Howard. You studied under him for 7 years until his death in 1992. And there were a few things that I learned on your website about Vernon I wanted to share and have you comment on. One of them is that Vernon said, if you are 100% afraid, the fear will fall away by itself.
Yeah.
He also said, stand and shake, but stand. And this was a vital lesson for you. Well, how was that a vital lesson for you?
Well, I had agoraphobia for many years. Anxiety just runs.
Agoraphobia.
What is it?
Agoraphobia.
Fear.
You don't know what agoraphobia is?
No.
It's fear of open places. That's the root Latin meaning of the word. But I was happier at home. I felt safe at home. And to venture out was frightening. It leads to panic attacks. And so for me to go out to Boulder City, Nevada, to meet Vernon was a big leap of faith for me. And he knew all about his students anyway. He never let on that he did, but he really knew all about us. But I can remember that he would make us get up in front of the class and give like little 30-second or 60-second talks, and people could see their fear, you know, because fear of public speaking is great. And he said, stand and shake, but stand. He was a fierce teacher. And when you met Vernon Howard, you met your shadow, guaranteed. You know, Irina Tweedy talks about sitting with her guru in her book, Daughter of Fire. And she said that, you know, to sit with him was to face the darkness in herself. And for me, that's what the path is about, facing the illusion that you're separate, because it's so convincing.
And everything is already known.
Yeah.
So when he says, be afraid 100%, he really means own the ultimate death of your personality, your personal ego.
Well, that one shred that fights your fear will keep it going is what he was saying. Hmm. And he was always encouraging people to fall apart. And that's why people would travel out there. People got sick, they got colds, they vomited, you know, they fell down. It was intense sadhana. The fire was very hot, because just one look at this man and you were just reduced to jelly. Now, he was like Gurdjieff. He scolded you with one hand and loved you with the next. You know, it was equal. You could not go there and just sit there and worship at his feet. He said things like, if you try to worship me, boy, will you get a clout. And so he kept everybody in a state of heightened misery. And I loved it. It was what I needed.
You know what I
wanted.
You know what I've noticed is that almost every single sage that we've interviewed on this program has had an extremely influential teacher. And yet now there's this explosion of wisdom on the internet. It's all over the place. There's hundreds of people who have got Facebook pages and blogs and books and all that. And so there's all these people out there who are sharing wisdom, but I have found in my own life here that first of all, the original experience that befell me came just completely out of the blue. And then after that, it was my association with the wizard here. And there's something unpalpable or undescribable about that present relationship where you're actually physically in someone's presence. You're gazing in their eyes. They're rock solid. There's somehow the rock solid kind of rubs off on you. But when you're just reading it on a blog or whatever, you know, it's nice. It feels good. But I wonder, can deep spiritual growth take place through the reading of a blog or a whatever, or is it only through initially a great teacher? Because I haven't seemed to see really almost anyone who wasn't profoundly influenced by someone else.
I agree with you, Tripp. I think it's very easily for the intellect to take the stage online and blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. And I care about that. Blah,
blah, good,
blah.
That'd be a good spiritual book. Blah, blah, blah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
We should keep a list of all these great book titles and just copyright
blah,
them.
Blah, blah, blah is a good one.
I think there has to be a strong element of shock in a good teacher. And Vernon Howard had that.
I've never heard of Vernon Howard before.
Really?
Yeah. But I'm not an academic. I mean, I don't know much about what's going on.
He was not an academic by any means. He spoke plain English, and he would not have used a word like guru, for instance.
Right on.
Teacher and class to him. But I was led there. Everybody that ended up with him was led there. There was no accident. And I believe I carry his energy, which is a very no-nonsense energy.
Is he still alive?
No, he's been dead 19 years. And I left the group, really didn't leave until after Bob got so ill, we couldn't travel out there anymore. And I believe I was supposed to come into my own as a writer. And that's what I've been doing now for, I've been writing online for about over 10 years.
My mentors took me to task for deification.
Yes.
I would deify somebody, and it would get smashed to smithereens over and over and over and over again.
That's the process, as I understand it.
Until I saw there is no Messiah.
No.
Just reflections. Just reflections.
And he would yell at us, "You don't exist. You don't exist. Like you think you do." You know? But he was ahead of the... Now everybody talks about Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi. Vernon was teaching the same thing, but he was just using his plain language. That's what I do when I write. I'm just writing English.
Well, you come across really, and I love your posts. I really do. I look forward to them every day.
It's my joy to write them. It really is. And I think we're seeing a huge paradigm shift right now on Facebook.
I do, too.
How do you feel about it, John?
I think the same thing that's happened to hierarchies and superiority, inferiority complexes politically are happening spiritually, and that religions and theology and the power structures and those who are held in subjugation in those structures or religions, That's all coming apart.
Absolutely.
All coming apart and there is a fellowship with no name on it.
Yeah.
That's global in scope and is love itself without any labels on it. And we meet like this in many different ways, and it reaffirms itself more and more. And I think it's going to lead to a critical mass.
I do, too. And it's like, I want to say, no sham, no scam.
Right on. Just clean.
No scam, no sham. I am.
Well, I agree with you guys to a degree. But,
you do?
Yeah, but I don't quite feel that fully agreed, because I see a kind of profile. Okay, I look at the people, and they're almost all in their 40s or 50s or 60s. I see very, very few people in their 20s or 30s. And I see most of the people on Facebook sharing in this way are people who are have the resources, they're retired, or they've got somebody else or whatever. They're not out there, like, you know, pouring concrete or whatever. And so I feel there's this, a little bit of insularity, and it, the whole movement may not be as large as we perceive it to be, because I don't see it at all out there when I'm just walking down the street or whatever. I mean, I don't, do you see anything out in the Gen Pop there? I don't.
When you buy a new Mercedes Benz and you're riding down the road, all of a sudden you've never seen so many Mercedes Benzes.
Yeah. I think spirituality is always a hidden quality. I don't think it's for the masses. I don't think the masses can awaken. I think you awaken one by one, and it takes an intense burning fire that you find ways to stay lit, and it's the few that make it out.
I agree.
Boy, I've been burned.
Yeah.
I've been burned, and my heart's been broken and shattered.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole gamut. I mean, you couldn't write a worse story or experience a greater blessing.
Exactly. So I think one thing that these Facebook people have in common, Trip, is that we're recognizing that many among us are really ready for the hermit life, the introverted life, where we're tired of going to social gatherings where nothing is said and nothing real happens. And at least online, you're free of that body-mind snag, that snare of having to play the game.
Well, speaking of these social contexts, I was at a gathering for summer solstice. It was also my birthday. And the people there were pretty awakened people, and I would say probably all of them were on a spiritual path. And I smoked a little weed before the thing got started, so I was very animated, and I was sharing some of my deepest convictions about this present reality. But not everyone really enjoyed this style of wisdom that I was sharing, because I was kind of lecturing, I guess. I was speaking boldly, you know, what I feel is true about our reality, without a real interest in where the others were coming from. The others were sharing their stuff. We were kind of going around in a circle, and they were sharing. But on your blog, you say the best way to share is by giving someone the water collected drop by drop from the cistern that has become your heart. I'm wondering if you, too, could share how you feel the deepest connections are made in social contexts. How do you really deeply relate with people who will find this particular kind of brand of non-dual reality that we're talking about now a little bit foreign? Do you just listen like crazy, or what do you do?
I'm not really out there. I'm pretty private.
I find confession. We had a gathering a few weeks ago called Wonderful, and about 80 or so gathered together at an inn in Western North Carolina, and it was truly wonderful. And one of the confessions I had, one of those little dark things, when my son was a baby, and in the crib he was crying and crying and crying, and the crying started aggravating me, and it was really irritating me. So and I put my hand over his mouth so he would breathe through his nose and not cry. And that haunted me for years and years and years. I never said anything about it, but it was there. And then here, almost 40 years later, I sat down with him and I said, you know, I have a confession, and it's more about me than it is you. But one time when you were a small baby in the crib, I put my hand over your mouth, and you couldn't express yourself, and you couldn't cry, and I want to apologize for that. And he shared with me that at that time, his heart just broke open to the infinite as I shared that confession. So sometimes these little tiny confessions that we make are are so meaningful for ourselves and with others, because if we hide the slightest little thing from an apparent other, it prevents a real communion, a real melting of that real solvent, as you say, from doing its work.
And you don't often get that chance in a social setting. I would say you never do. Like the wonderful gathering, that was not social, that was a spiritual gathering.
Yeah, it was coming together in the spirit of oneness.
But as I say, I think everything is destined. There have been many times when I wished I had the gift of gab. I'm not good at small talk. I love to talk like we're talking now, heart to heart. But I'm really not good at small talk. But I think that my life has been destined to be an introverted, quiet life, so I could give myself over to do what I came in to do.
I never thought of myself as an introverted person, but in the past few years, I find myself at home with my wife a lot. She gets up early. I get up a little later. She goes to bed earlier. I stay up later. I'm by myself. It's quiet. The TV doesn't grab me. And I've read enough books. And I just sit.
You just sit.
Just sit.
Yes.
And it's nice.
It is.
There's no motivation to it. It's just like a kitty.
Well, you know, I talk about my friend Peter in the book, about how he would sit in the sunlight with the little cat on his chest. That's all he could do. He could barely walk. So he would get himself out into the yard and sit there, and he said he would watch the robins run and listen to the little cat purr.
Mm. Yeah, that friend of yours, Peter, was inspirational. The guy, you said he had to crawl to the bathroom. It took him 2 years to learn how to crawl to the bathroom. And then said he would fall down all the time, and he'd fall down in the grass. And while he would fall down in the grass, he'd like get into the grass. He'd like say, wow, look at that.
You know, he started sentient.org. Have either one of you remember that website?
No.
Mm-mm.
Well, it was one of the first spiritual sites.
Is it still up?
No, it's gone now. And Peter died some years back. But when I was going through it with Bob, he would say, for what it's worth, I hold your hand in this. He was not afraid to talk about suffering. He said, when I yell, I yell. When I'm in pain, I scream. But then it passes.
Yeah.
So Peter and I had this mutual experience of walking through the fire together. And he got fed up with satsang. He said, I found out when I had all these strokes and I didn't know who I was and all that, these people couldn't dole out any helpful advice to me. But one day he just woke up. He said, I just woke up and I saw that I was as big as the sky. He said, my me had gone.
Oh, yes.
My me had gone. And he was a brilliant man, and I never knew his last name.
Huh.
Beautiful.
Always had these threads of grace running through the hard times. Always had somebody at hand to share with.
You write, why is a word that says I can understand mentally why things happen like they do? It is a stupid substitute for living your life as a servant of life. Can you give us an example of living your life as a servant of life, maybe that's played out in the last week or something?
I have taken every day this month to make sure when I wake up in the morning that I am established in peace, and I'm doing it just one day at a time. The best way for me to be a servant of life is to stay very, very true to myself, to not do things that are against me. Hmm. Because self-division is bad. It's unhealthy for me. And I say, if it's right for me, it's right for the universe. So if something is feeling wrong for me, and I'm tempted to do something for somebody else, good, but it's wrong for me. I have to remind myself, excuse me, if it feels wrong for me, then it's wrong for them too. You know, it's that clear. You have to get it that clear.
Amen.
And so I don't do a lot. I'm not a doer, which limits my social circle even further.
Wow.
Because when you go around not doing things for people, you know, you don't have many people in your life. And that leaves plenty of room for the Spirit.
You know, that's really, what do you call wisdom that's like just in time or speaks right to you in the moment? But I've been struggling over a business agreement with some investors, and it wasn't until the wizard urged me to, and I'll put it in a, just urged me to really take care of myself, take care of my children, take care of other people that have invested in me, and not just be sort of in this polar dialogue with this one investor, but to take the whole basket of service into consideration. I demanded, and this was extremely difficult for me, I demanded that they be taken care of, or I was willing to go to DEFCON 5, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it shifted the whole conversation. And now, in fact, these folks that I love that are my investors are in a better situation, because what's resulted is that now both of us are going to be working full-time on this situation instead of just one of us. That has got to be in the best interest of both parties, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so I didn't really even realize that before. I wasn't even thinking, you know what? We're going to have four eyeballs on this thing instead of two. But now that we've agreed and kind of the stress is off.
Yeah, your truth is the most powerful thing you own.
Yeah.
That you are, however you want to say it.
It takes courage.
It does. And I think that's why I wanted a tough teacher.
Yeah.
Oh, and he came to me in a dream after he died, several months after he died, and he said to me, "Don't be so accommodating. Act a little tough." And I said, if he took the trouble to come back to me after he died and tell me that, I better listen.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a sage on the show about 2 weeks ago, Jerry Wenstrom, and he just surrendered to God. He didn't know where he was going to eat or what he was going to do or whatever. And I confided something about my personality. And he said, you know, your issue, Trip, is that you're a nice guy. And what you really need to do is you need to toughen up, dude.
I actually met Jerry.
Oh, really?
You did?
I actually went to Whitby and met Jerry.
Cool.
And he was pretty strict with me, too. He's one tough cookie.
Yeah.
I have great respect for Jerry. And Whitby Island is a PowerPoint for sure.
We got about 7-8 more minutes. You write, prayers of the heart are written in true ink. What's true ink?
The truth.
Like the unvarnished, ugly truth? Like all the warts and all, like that?
The truth to me is who we are. And I think that essay I was talking about, tears. Didn't I say something about tears?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've had a very sad personal life. I mean, there's no getting around it. And I do get fed up with these neo-Advaita people that say, oh, well, you know, drop your story. And I say, well, if you've buried a child and a husband, you come back then and tell me. Was it that easy to drop your story? I use my story consciously as a stepping stone. I use it as service.
It's a true confession.
It's a true confession. It's a worthy confession. It's my journey.
You earned it.
So I will never stop. I'm fearless about dipping back into my pain, and I find that when I do, it's always somebody out there is listening and saying thank you.
Well, Eckhart Tolle talks about the now, the power of now, and he talks about how we kind of split our, we waste ourselves by giving attention to the past and to the future, which actually don't exist. And so
right.
that teaching had a pretty powerful impact on me. And I don't really enjoy photographs that much, and I don't really want to go down memory lane that much because I do not want my attention to be placed in a place that doesn't exist, which is the past, which is the death of people, which is whatever. So I'm kind of anti-memory lane, but the two of you kind of, you don't agree with that.
The memory comes back into the present.
I am like you, Tripp, in that I do not look at photographs, and I'm not a historian. I think the difference with me is I use it as a writing tool. You know, I'm consciously using it.
Yeah.
It's part of my work.
Right. You're consciously using it.
And yeah. I use it as a confessional, like with my son at the Wonderful Gathering.
Yeah, that,
I mean, that was going back a long, long way, but it was a little something in there that I'd kind of covered over.
The danger for me in the Neo-Advaita group is that they're papering over too much.
Mm-hmm.
And like John says, it does a little good to peel that paper back and take a look.
We have some people in the Neo-Advaita that we interviewed now. Who's it? Craig Hamilton. He's got an organization called Enlightenment something. And he's firmly convinced that those in the Neo-Advaita community have an obligation to the world to put their teaching into practice and to actively help others and to sort of fight the good fight. Are you on that page? Because I don't think the wizard is. He doesn't really believe in that.
My teacher said, "Do gooders or do badders," and I subscribe to that.
I'm a rascal. I fess it on up. Right up front.
The wizard
said, if
I am
gave
no saint.
People $1 million to get rid of their slums, he said in a year the slum will be back because their consciousness hasn't changed.
Hmm.
Work on changing your own consciousness first before you think you can go out there and change the world. That's what I subscribe to.
I'm torn on this because the wizard is he's anti-activism. He doesn't have an activist bone in his body, but there's no question that those who have gone before us, people like Martin Luther King and all kinds of people that have been activists, have made for a more livable world, a more peaceful world, a more joyous place where the races can interact. Or people of, for example, activists, just homosexuals just got in New York State, they just got the right to marry. And I was looking at the joy in these folks who've been denied equal rights or whatever. They wouldn't have those equal rights without the activists. So what do you say, Wizard? I mean,
that's their dharma. That's their role. We all have our dharma.
Yeah.
And dharma is what happens when the doership is gone. And life doesn't stop happening.
Like, I work on my consciousness every day. But I'm not working on anything out there. I'm working on stuff in here.
Mm-hmm.
And my work is primarily to witness Vicky and what she's up to.
Hmm.
Sometimes
yeah.
she's up to no good, you know.
You don't apologize for it either, do you?
I would.
Well, I got one last question for you because we got about two more minutes. Okay, you don't apologize for the illogic or the paradox of your teaching. For example, you've offered to hold people at a still point with zero idea how that might actually work. Like, you got no idea, you know. Are the people out there who are governed by reason, who have sensibly avoided cults, doomsday preparations, orbiting Palladians, you know, the rapture insurance policies for pet care? Okay.
You lost me on this question.
Right. I'm
the
saying...
Still point, though.
My point is that how do you tell the difference between someone who's just kind of hanging with the unexplainable and, like, for example, you put this thing up there. You said, you know, I'm going to hold you in a still point. I don't even need to know what the situation is. Just email me and I will hold you in a still point. And you felt that this was helpful. There are other people out there that will take out a crystal in a traveling circus show and say, you know, just look in the crystal and this will help you. I mean, how does somebody draw a valid line between being comfortable with the illogical, paradoxical, irrational reality that we have and then quackery.
Well, Patricia's son said logically it was over last week. Holding people at the still point is what Joel Goldsmith did. All healers heal by being who they are. And I can get to the still point.
That's the
solvent.
There
now.
That's the solvent.
Yeah.
That's that's the medicine.
Right.
That's the medicine. I'm a medicine woman.
So
in
you,
that sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm serious, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It certainly can't hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And in stillness, there is no division.
Absolutely.
Okay, I got one more question quick. We got nobody's coming up behind us. There's nobody in the studio. Okay, here's this last one. All right? This is about the void. Now, I have not had the personal experience of the void. I've had a lot of experiences,
You can't because you're not left.
All right. I mean, the wizard is slap blacked out and then come to and he was like somewhere else and he doesn't know what happened in between, okay? He says he was in the void and, you know, that's because he can recognize that he doesn't know what happened in this time interval and he's in a new place and what the heck, yeah, he was completely...
No phenomena.
Right, completely blacked out. And there's this thing, you say, rest in the void. The void takes care of its own, okay? But when I personally rest in open awareness, which is awareness without thought and just dig on that, right? But it's not a void. It's actually pleasant. I don't know. It's not nothing. It's awareness. So what is it, the void or awareness? I'm confused by this.
It's the one and the same thing.
Okay.
It's the same thing.
It's like dreamless sleep.
It's pure silence. Pure silent awareness.
Okay.
Where there is no other.
Mm. Where there is no other.
Well, on that, we wrap up our first edition of the revamped Conversations with Avant-Garde Sages. And Vicki, you've been a fantastic first guest.
Great conversation.
So I had a wonderful time with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicki. And keep those posts coming.
Oh, I shall.
And we're going to enjoy the heck out of you on the internet. We'll stay in close touch. And I will send you an MP3 of this program. And,
okay.
You'll be posted on our website as soon as I get my computer back online. And my kid dropped a glass of water on it.
Thanks both of you so much.
Was it your kid that damaged the computer or the water?
Oh, well, I told her it was her. That was yeah. Oh, yeah.
Confession time for you and your future.
Love you, Vicki. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.